Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all. This is another live edition of Canada's most irreverent talk show, The Andrew Lawton Show, here on True North, just after 1 o'clock Eastern from my favorite city in I'm in Ottawa, never mind. Not usually my favorite city. It's a city I have a weird love-hate more hate relationship with, but you have important people here and important events, and we are at one of the most important, certainly on the conservative calendar in this country, the Canada Strong and Free Network's annual conference taking place at the West in Ottawa for the next few days. It's a place where I think close to 1,000 Canadian conservatives are set to descend. We have some foreign speakers like former Australian and British Prime Ministers Tony Abbott and Boris Johnson. We also have the conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. I think there's one guest that hasn't yet been announced that I think is sure to make some waves as well. So all of this is to say it's going to be a great week. We're going to be doing the show live every day at the usual time and also doing some other interviews with some of the phenomenal figures who are walking the halls. We have some lined up, and in some cases we're literally just going to lasso them as they walk by, because we're broadcasting from the exhibit hall here. Quite a nice upgrade from the crappy hotel room set I had going on yesterday. We decided to pull out all the stops here. And what better way to kick things off than and to speak with Adam Bolek, who's the president of the Canada Strong and Free Network. Adam, good to talk to you. Thanks for having us here, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So this is your first of these conferences as president. It's a bit of a baptism by fire for you, but tell me about the theme, Leading with Conviction. Where does that come from, and what does it really mean?
Look, there's no doubt that there's a lot of momentum in the conservative movement right now. You see it at Pierre's rallies. You see it out west in Alberta with Premier Smith. You see it in New Brunswick with Premier Higgs. You see it with all of our friends here that are setting up booths and getting ready for the discussions and the conference we're about to have. I think the biggest thing I want folks to think about with this conference is we are positioned for a big win across the country, I think. How do we take advantage of it? How do we actually get things done? I think, you know, the next couple of years look less like 2006 or less like 1984 in this country and more like 1995, as it was in Ontario, where there was a huge mandate to get some things changed and a lot of buy-in, I think, from the people of Canada to go in a very different and honestly a more conservative direction. And so that's what I want people to think about. I want them to think about what are the conservative things we want to accomplish as a country, not just with government, across civil society, in the courts, in the boardrooms, in church groups. What are the things we want to accomplish, and how do we really harvest or harness this momentum?
There's always been a bit of a challenge when you talk about politics in Canada, and that you have the ideologies underlying the political parties that have the same word as the parties themselves. And, you know, you have this big C, small C conservative divide, this big L, small L liberal. And I'm curious how you approach that issue, because obviously there are a lot of partisan conservatives here. You've got provincial premiers like Danielle Smith and Blaine Higgs, who I'll be speaking to on stage in the next couple of days. You've got conservative leader Pierre Poilievre speaking, but it's not a capital C partisan conservative event. So where do you think the movement aspect fits into what you're doing here?
I think there's a number of core principles we all share across the conservative movement that people, I don't want to say pick and choose from, but they may lean into certain things than others, right? So if you're more economically minded or you're more libertarian, you may have more affinity for a taxpayers group or for some of the things that our friends at the MLI are doing. You may be a foreign affairs hawk, and you may be more interested in Prime Minister Abbott or Prime Minister Prime Minister Johnson will have to say, or some of our other guests that are talking a lot about foreign policy, particularly on Friday. So I think there's something for everyone here at this conference, and I want everybody to lean into the things that they believe in and that they find conviction in, right? And so it's a big movement. It's a broad movement. We're covering all kinds of issues. But I think the things that unite us certainly is that need for change. And everybody sees something that they want to see done in this country that are united around those core principles. And as I said, it's personal liberty, it's freedom, it's certainly limited and smaller government, and I think it's moral clarity in our foreign affairs now more than ever.
There's been, over the last few years in particular, I think a profound shift in Canadian politics, but especially in the conservative movement. And you look at some of the key changes here, like the ousting of Jason Kenney in Alberta, and then Danielle Smith coming in, the ousting of Aaron O'Toole in at the Canadian level, and Pierre Poilievre coming in. And I'm wondering, you know, obviously, again, I go back to this is your first kick at this particular can in this role. But how does that weigh into the discussions that you have? The fact that there has been a major, I don't want to say a turnover, but certainly an expansion of the conservative movement to people that are not traditional lifelong partisans, let alone conservative partisans.
I think there are these moments that happen every 10 or 15 years. Maybe it's once in a generation, I'm not sure. But there are these moments that there is a sea change and there is a shift. And I think you saw it in the 1990s across the country, whether even in places like the United States or in Great Britain or our cousins in Australia. And so I think those changes in sentiment and in feeling, and particularly for conservatives, those are driven by economic hard times, really, or a loss or lack of opportunity. And I think that's what brings people who may not have been engaged in politics, whether it be from the think tank world or in an activist role or in partisan politics, that's what really activates them and brings them in. And there's generational change, right? I think about rallies that I went to, Andrew, 20 years ago, or events like this 20 years ago. It was very different than now. I was usually the youngest person in the room. I'm 38 years old. I'm going to be one of the oldest people at this conference now. I'm an old man now. And I'm struggling with that.
It sneaks up on you fast, that feeling.
Tell me about
it.
Tell me about it. But I think you can see, and you see it at all the rallies you see on TV, and you see it in the States, and you see it everywhere else. So I think it's just part of a natural cycle and part of that generational change.
What is the aspect that you would love people like Tony Abbott and Boris Johnson to bring to the table? I mean, both very, very different political leaders in their respective countries. And oftentimes in the past, I mean, the big foreign speakers at this conference have typically been American, because I think there's a lot of influence, if you're a Canadian conservative, from the American realm. So what is it you'd love for these guys to bring to the table?
I think for Prime Minister Abbott in particular, if you look at his campaign for Prime Minister a decade ago, he was not the most popular leader coming into it, but he was seen as a very conservative and a movement-based figure, very pro-life, very limited government. And he had this mantra when he was getting elected, and it was this: stop the boats, because they had a huge immigration issue at the time. It was axe the tax. That might sound familiar. And these were two positions that were not popular or not seen to be popular widely with the electorate. But that is how he came to be in power, and that's how he won his election. And so I think talking about the ability to push back against the narrative that was out there in Australia at the time, to have conviction in his beliefs that what he was seeing and how he was responding to it in a conservative way was the right thing to do, and he had to lead and convince Australians to vote for him. And I think for Prime Minister Johnson, it's the same. No question, his work on Brexit is why, and his championing of that cause is why it got done. And he saw to it when he eventually then became leader and prime minister and delivered Brexit. And I think for him as well, conviction in his beliefs on things like Israel and Ukraine is another one where we're seeing the movement has very different views about what to do about Ukraine, as you know. And I think Mr. Johnson has been anything if not consistent in his view that the West should support Ukraine in any way it can, that there is evil in the world, we must confront it, and it's never nice, and it's always ugly, but it's the right thing to do. And it harkens back, I think, to a heritage in the conservative movement, going back to the Reagan era, and Margaret Thatcher and Brian Mulroney, and having that moral clarity in foreign policy.
So Ukraine brings up a useful launching point for something I wanted to ask you in general, which was about how you deal with these schisms. I mean, we've seen internal conflict in the conservative movement on things that like foreign policy, and I think you see that especially now about, you know, interventionist versus realist views on foreign policy, things like supply management. I mean, anyone who was around in the 2017 conservative leadership race 100%. would have thought, again, it's an important issue, would have thought that was probably the most pressing issue because of how much oxygen it was taking. Yep. Certainly in COVID, we saw a fair split in parts of the right on how to handle that. So how do you grapple, if at all, with those issues at a forum like this, where on one hand, you don't want this to be about infighting, but you also don't want to shy away from these things, which are very real and very relevant questions for the right to take up?
I think the conference is exactly how you do it. I think having these debates and having these discussions and hearing from experts in the movement are how you do it. And I think a lot of it is because I think folks have spent some time looking at these issues or reading into them. But it's different when you actually get together in a room with 1,000 conservatives and hash it out and hear from world leaders and hear from experts about the issues at hand. And maybe it'll change some minds. Maybe it'll harden some stances. I don't know. But if there's any forum to do it, it's here at CSFN in Ottawa and the other conferences and events that we do. I think it's a healthy tension. I think, look, we're a very democratic movement, very grassroots oriented. And we want to hear those voices, and we want to have those debates. And the movement will find consensus. It always does. But it doesn't happen overnight. It takes time. And maybe there'll be a consensus on Ukraine one way or the other, or on carbon taxes, or on any issue you want to pick in the next 5 years. But it takes time.
Your predecessor in your role as president, Jamil Giovanni, was just sworn in 2 days ago as a member of parliament. So I don't know if that's prescient for your ambitions, but I will ask you what stamp you're bringing to the organization. What is the shade of Adam Bullock that we see in the program this year?
A lot of people have been calling me Bay Street Bullock because of my background in lobbying and corporate affairs. And
you're one of those.
I know that has caused some angst in the movement, and some folks have said some things. But when I came into this gig, I said I really wanted a conference that I would want to go to, and I wanted to keep it as interesting and as exciting, and I wanted to have a lot of momentum and a lot of fun. And that's how the approach I took with the program. I wanted it to be bold. I wanted it to be broad and different. And I wanted to elevate it, too. I see all kinds of, because of this gig I have, I see all kinds of conferences that the Americans do, our friends in the UK. And I want ours to be as successful. And I want, frankly, our cousins from around the world in the conservative movement to come to Ottawa next year and to be part of this as we go to theirs.
All right. Well, we look forward to it. Adam Bullock, the president of the Canada Strong and Free Network, and you've allowed me on the stage a couple of times. So I don't know if your Bay Street friends might disavow you now.
But, we're going to have you twice this year. It's going
to
be
awesome. Yes, I know. I get to be moderating the discussion with Premier Blaine Higgs from New Brunswick and also with Premier Danielle Smith from Alberta.
No one better to do it.
The next 2 days. So I look forward to that. Adam, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. This is great.
All right. Thank you so much. And we are going to shift gears and have a discussion. Just a few moments with someone who has been at the forefront of a lot of these very debates and discussions that have taken place in Canadian politics. We've had him on the show on a number of occasions. Aaron Woodrick heads the domestic policy program with the Macdonald Laurier Institute. And one of the big, bold questions that I think a lot of people have always wanted to find a conservative position on that is saleable, that is relevant, has been that of immigration. And we had a great chat with Aaron about this on the show a couple of weeks back. I think Candace Malcolm did as well on her show. But there's one of many issues in the domestic policy realm. Aaron, good to have you on in person. Thanks for being with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
So just from you as a domestic policy guy, also someone who's been broadly involved in the right-of-center world in Canada for quite some time, what do you want to see a forum like this used for? What are the issues you think need to be front and center?
Well, I mean, like, first and foremost now, I'm with a policy outfit, so I'm very much concerned about policy. The horse race stuff, the slogans of the campaign, that's all fun and interesting, and I did that. I had my time as a campaign manager back in the day, but I'm very interested in, you know, what comes next. So, you know, everyone says don't get ahead of yourselves, governments change, don't count your chickens in terms of an election. But, you know, I think winning in some ways when the wind's at your back, that's the easy part. The hard part comes when you're governing. And right now, you know, Mr. Polyev, the wind's at his back. I think he's identified all the issues that Canadians are concerned about. The question is getting into the details of those solutions. So whether it's things like housing, whether it's addressing immigration, what does a climate policy look like without a carbon tax? These are questions. CBC, it's easy to say cut $1 billion out. What does that look like? Right. So these are the sorts of questions as a think tank we put our minds to. And, you know, we put those ideas out there for any government. It doesn't seem that this current government's that interested in some of those solutions, but we're hoping that maybe a future government will be.
The politics-policy divide is actually a fascinating one. And I think oftentimes, for good reason, people have viewed them as really mutually exclusive in a way. And sure. I think I've talked on the show in the past. I have a book coming out about Pierre Poilievre. And one of the things that I think has made him such an interesting political figure is that he seems to have a grasp of both. He understands the snappy slogans, but he also understands the policy underlying it. For you as a policy person, you must understand that communicating things that are dealt with in white papers and really technical materials is very difficult to people, but it also matters. It's not the slogan that's going to cause their taxes to go up or down. It's the policy itself. So how do you bridge that divide? How do you actually make policy saleable and relevant to people that have a hard enough time just dealing with, like, their life, let alone, you know, reading the 300-page white paper on immigration?
Sure. I mean, if it was easy, everyone would do it, right? And the reality that something that we try and the role we play as a think tank is we try and bridge that gap between sort of expertise. Sometimes it's seen as ivory tower and academic. And then, you know, on the other end where you have empty slogans and there's no meat behind them. I think there's a way to bridge that gap. I think a lot of that comes down to your communication skill. It comes down to identifying really simple principles that people just sort of intuitively understand. You'll know this being in media as well. Sometimes it's about the story. It's about the narrative. That doesn't mean you can't have some sort of substance or policy behind it, but you have to find a way to communicate it to people that resonates, that they can grasp it almost intuitively without having to read a 50-page paper to understand.
Yeah, I think it was Second Street, maybe a year ago or 2 years ago, they launched this Victims of Communism or Victims of Socialism series, where they just had these human faces of people that have lived through regimes that are quite, you know, brutal to their people. And it was a very compelling way of telling the story. I think you have to have both, really. You have to have the story the way that's going to get people's attention, but you also have to have that data underlying it. And to bring it back to the immigration discussion, this is an issue where pretty much everyone in this country has met an immigrant. They've probably met many of them. Maybe they themselves are immigrants. And you can talk about all the data you want. You can talk about housing. You can talk about, you know, figures like, you know, the deal with integration, social service availability, all of that. But it's such a polarized issue because you're talking about people. You're talking about people of different backgrounds. So how do you have that, to follow up on the discussion you and I had a few weeks back, how do you have that grown-up discussion on immigration when no one actually seems to be, or I shouldn't say no one, few people seem able to separate from the emotion the things about this issue that make it so important?
Yeah. I think one of the things we always need to remember is we don't want to commit what's called the aggregation fallacy. When we're talking about individuals, when we talk about individual migrants, immigrants, people we meet, these are human beings. Most people don't bear ill will to, you know, random people they've never met before. And then in the aggregate, we're talking about a number. I mean, we're talking about essentially, if you look at it in a purely economic terms, we're talking about supply spikes for housing. We're talking about crunches on things like infrastructure and doctors. So when we have a debate about how many, what should our immigration level be, we're really talking about that aggregate, right? That's not an attack on individuals. That's not saying, you know, this or that immigrant, that person is a bad person. And we have a hard time getting away from that for a long time. Anyone who sort of raised any issue about, are we maybe taking more than we can handle right now, was framed as attacking or even racist. Yeah. I think that's changing now. I think even this government has realized that we have, the numbers are unprecedented, and True North has done a good job, you know, sort of highlighting some of these numbers. So I think we're moving in the direction of that mature conversation. Little ways to go to get there, but the signs are encouraging.
Well, since you mentioned the Liberal government, I wanted to ask about that, because that admission from Justin Trudeau last week or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, that, you know, we have absorbed something far beyond, that's what he said, absorbed far beyond what Canada can handle or Canada can manage. That's something that I think that man himself would have said was racist if it was uttered a year ago by Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre or by anyone else, by me. And when he's coming out and saying it, do you think it's an example of the is he behind where a consensus has already shifted in Canada on this issue?
I think so. I mean, look, you can call it cynical and opportunistic to flip-flop. Mm-hmm. That's true. But I'd also rather say, you know, they've realized that that's where most Canadians are, is that I think most Canadians generally are probably more open than just about any other people on the planet in terms of immigration. That doesn't mean there's no limit. That doesn't mean they have an unlimited tolerance for things like crazy housing prices and not being able to find a doctor and things like that. So I welcome that shift. I do find it a little bit interesting, like this and other issues. Now the Liberal government seems to not want to say who was responsible for putting us in this situation.
Yeah, it's that old, I don't know how it happened. They just showed up one day.
And I've said this, and others said this elsewhere, is that, boy, if you look at their track record, this certainly seems like a record they'd be happy to campaign against if they were in opposition.
Yeah, that's a very good point on this. And it puts the Conservatives, and this is where you probably get annoyed, because now all of a sudden we pull it out of the policy realm. But the Conservatives have, I think, been, I've used the word timid in the past on this, because I think the Conservatives are seeing that a lot of immigrants in this country are very fed up with Justin Trudeau and the Liberals. A lot of immigrant communities, Jason Kenney did tremendous work to reach out to them. Pierre Poilievre has as well. And in a weird way, it seems like the Liberals have almost outflanked the Conservatives on the issue. And I'm curious what you're thinking on that. Is because I would love to see everyone just say, all right, this is not political. This is the good of the country. This is our economic welfare. This is the cohesion of Canadian society. But that's not how politics tends to work.
Yeah, look, I think that the Liberal government's shift on this, I mean, I think they can largely justify on grounds of housing. And I know that, for example, Mr. Poilievre, one of the things he did say was that we need to tie the rate of immigration to the rate of housing starts. I think that's a kind of I believe even Sean Fraser said that seemed like a reasonable proposition.
You know,
so I think that's a good thing. You know, I think for conservatives, especially, you know, historically, some of the challenges they've had, you know, being seen as perhaps less welcoming to immigrants than the Liberal Party, there's probably more trepidation there. That's understandable. I frankly think Mr. Poilievre has been commendable in, you know, not not blaming immigrants for the problem. He's pointed out that in many cases they are as much victims as Canadians are, right? He's not saying it's not their fault. They get here and they were sold a bill of goods. So I actually think that's a healthy thing. And I think we also need to be mindful that in spite of the fact, I believe that most Canadians who have concerns about immigration are in good faith and they're not people who are discriminatory or prejudiced, there are bad faith actors out there. And we don't want to give those people a platform to basically argue against all immigration in any case, anywhere whatsoever, which I think is, I don't think there's that many of those people, but we do have to be mindful that they're up.
No, and I think that's the incredibly important point here, is that when people like you and I have this discussion, and pretty much everyone I meet in respectable society, which I guess one day I might be a member of, common sense immigration is the goal. So even when you say fewer immigrants, you're not saying no immigration, you're not saying end immigration, and you're not saying less immigration for the sake of there being less immigration. And I think that's the crucial point, is that oftentimes when someone says, what Pierre Poilievre said on my show in December, which is, we need to tie immigration to housing, doctors, and jobs. Yes, I think a lot of people could read between the lines and say he's probably talking about a lower number, at least for the time being. Sure. But it's not lower because he wants fewer immigrants. It's lower because he wants the immigration system to work. Yeah. And I mean, people can agree or disagree with the position, but I think that's the crucial difference here.
Yeah, I think that there's sort of a spectrum of opinion on immigration, and that window shifts based on things like housing prices, on jobs, right, on incomes, opportunity, doctors, infrastructure. So if those things are taken care of, I think you have a wider acceptance and tolerance and appetite for immigration. When those things are all problems, immigration then kind of gets reduced to essentially just creating problems on the demand side, because that is the one variable that governments can control. If you have a problem with demand, you can kind of turn off the taps. You can tighten the screws on it, so to speak. So, I don't look, there are other challenges with immigration, issues of integration and identity. These are the thorniest parts that I think a lot of people are still uncomfortable getting into. But I think by and large, most of it is still economically driven. And if that's addressed, I think you kind of take a lot of air out of that balloon.
So from a policy perspective, how do you deal with the value question? Because I think there's still a lot of trauma, to use that term, in the right from the 2015 election, which was an election in which the Canadian values question was put forward. I think there was a fair bit of disingenuousness in how that policy was criticized by people. But I think it was also, you need to have the conversation in society and in culture before politicians can pick it up. And I don't think we've had that in the last decade.
No, and I mean, if I can be frank, I think one of the real the things that has opened a lot of folks' eyes is what's happened since October 7th. And some of these protests we've seen, for lack of a better word, there's anti-Semitism. There's been lots of attacks on Jews in Canada and Jewish Canadians. It's anti-Semitism full stop. And, this was not the case 20 or 30 years ago. And so a lot of people, this is an example when we talk about, cultural friction. And I also think it's wrong to say, well, the problem is immigration from Muslim countries. I'm saying, well, the vast majority of folks from these countries are not the ones at these rallies. And yet there is still a problem here. So how do we square the circle? How do we treat this issue seriously without understating or overstating the case? This is something serious that we have to grapple with, regardless of which government's in power.
Yeah, and there was a poll that the UK Telegraph had put out of British Muslims, and it found that one in four British Muslims polled believed that Hamas had committed murder and rape on October 7th. Now, I don't know in a Canadian context what those numbers would be, but if you were to see something similar, or even just to use the UK example, that's a big problem. If you can't even have a core group of that population agree that what happened even happened, let alone what was wrong. And the fractures are not going away. We're seeing now, for the continuation, this last 6 months and further, we're seeing pretty much on a weekly basis these sorts of protests. And there are these little peaks, but, it's Jewish neighborhoods that are being targeted, Jewish businesses. And are you optimistic that that can be translated into this adult conversation on Canadian values? Or, if anything, do people just retreat?
Yeah, it's extremely explosive. And one of the challenges that in a liberal democracy, how do you screen for the sorts of things that we're talking about, right? Like, we all can remember Kelly Leach's Canadian values test, right? And, widely mocked at the time, but yet when you drill down to it, the idea of having some kind of test where you can filter out, the problematic people from the wrong places, in a perfect world, that's how you would stop these ideas from getting into Canada. But what kind of tests, what would that look like? How would we get there, right? And, I mean, this is a really challenging debate.
And it would be one of those tests where there's a clear right answer to every question. And then you get the other thing of, are these views, for example, if you were to say, do you believe the Holocaust happened? And that was your one of your Canadian values questions that you asked. Would people, are people proud and loud and say, you know, absolutely, I'm a Holocaust denier? Or do they be like, okay, I'm going to answer it this way because I know that's what they want. And then it ceases to be a meaningful tool for immigration.
Plus, the other thing is that, I mean, we live in a obviously highly digital world now. Mm-hmm. Ideas can cross borders whether or not people are physically here. So if you manage to keep out the individuals with these views, what's to say they're still not going to be able to access them at the click of a button? Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I guess that the question is, do we need to go back even further and define what Canadian values are? Because I think there's a lot of relativism in this, where if you were to go and poll, you know, Canadians born in Canada who've only ever lived in Canada, say, what's a Canadian value? You're probably going to get some very superficial answers, I think. Sure. I think you're going to get hockey and maple syrup and, you know, kindness, which are core things. But really, to get down to the values of, you know, what you need to build a society, do we have that in this country?
Yeah, and I mean, the one way to look at it is that we're just part of a sort of broad, you know, Western civilization. We all, you know, the countries have similar values. What makes Canada distinct? Is there something different? Mm-hmm. Do we basically have the same values as Australia or the UK or US or some combination thereof? So, you know, as a country that often struggles to define itself, I think that puts us in a particularly challenging spot vis-a-vis some of our peers.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of know who they are to start with, and so they can measure people coming and adapting, you know, because they've got a starting point. In Canada, it's sort of like we're struggling with that starting point in the first place. So it is a battle here.
All right. Well, Aaron Woodrick, looking forward to seeing what you do at the conference this week. We are live from the Canada Strong and Free Network Conference in Ottawa. Thank you so much for coming by, Aaron.
Always
good to
a pleasure.
Talk to you. All right. Thanks very much. We'll get you to exit stage left there. And we were trying to hide. Oh, there we go. We were trying to hide our stage magic from you, but we failed at doing so. But that's all right. We will have a great time with this. And just on that note, I think it's incredibly important here that we have the discussion in society and in culture. And I'm often asked about the value of independent media. And I think the reason is that politicians are, and we're going to talk to one in just a couple of moments here, are inherently followers. And that's not to say you don't have politicians that really want to lead, but there needs to be a base of support on an issue, on a discussion, before they can even do that, before they could even get involved in that debate. So I had the great privilege on Monday of emceeing the swearing-in ceremony of Jamil Giovanni, who was just elected a little over a month ago as the Conservative Member of Parliament in Durham, and he joins us now. Jamil, congratulations. Good to talk to you, sir.
Yeah, good to see you here.
Yeah, so I had joked when I swore him in that if Justin Trudeau found out I was the MC, they might have actually rescinded the election results. But they didn't. You took the oath. You signed in. You even got the chance to ask a question in question period on Monday. Just on that note, and this isn't even a partisan question, but how does it feel? Because you're a guy that's come through tremendous adversity. You've written about it. You've conquered many challenges. But is there a moment when you walk into that house and you're just, wow?
It is overwhelming. I mean, I'm a patriot. I love Canada. I think we live in an awesome country, and that's one of the reasons I want to help fix it from our current leadership in Ottawa. And you know, when you're in there and you see like the history, and you know the generations of people who've been in there and tried to build something special, it hits you. It hits you hard, and it puts into perspective, you know, where we are, which is that we have benefited from the hard work of many people who came before us, the generations that built Canada, and now it's sort of on us. Like, do we keep this country, you know, do we maintain it to be something special, a place where people from all over the world can come and have a better life, or do we wind up, you know, losing what we built? And it really puts into respect when you see all the portraits on the walls and the old furniture, just you know, how deep that foundation is. Yeah.
I was mentioned earlier on when I was speaking with Adam Bolick, who's the president of the Canada Strong and Free Network, that you had the job last time.
I did,
You were here. You and I had a conversation with you in a different role here. So just how does it feel to be back here now? In this new capacity, you've left the presidency behind, and you're now back as an MP.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, this is an important organization for building our movement, and our party needs a healthy conservative movement, which is why I was very happy to have this role. And you know, now that I'm, you know, in the party and I'm in sitting in Parliament, I don't lose that perspective. I know how important the non-governmental organizations are to make sure that we have a just country and a country that pursues the best ideas.
You spoke in your question on Monday about basically the millennial struggle that I think has become pretty common, commonly shared by not just Pierre Poilievre and people in your party, but by people in this country. You know, you've got the millennials that can't afford to buy houses. You've got people that are priced out of the communities that they've always wanted to live in and have grown up in. And you've lived that struggle yourself. And I mean, I don't want to, you know, MP's just got a pay raise this year. So I'm not going to say, you know, everyone feel bad for Jamil Giovanni. You're doing all right now. But this has been a challenge that you've lived. And the government has talked about it, but they've not offered any solutions on this, have they?
No, the Liberal government certainly has not. I mean, the truth is that millennials put Justin Trudeau in the prime ministership.
Yeah.
It was our generation who elected him because he promised us something better. And I think we're going to be the generation that takes him down. We're going to be the generation that elects his replacement, who will elect Pierre Poilievre to be the next prime minister, because we've given Justin Trudeau and the Liberals 8 years and our lives have only gotten harder. I knocked on over 100,000 doors in my riding of Durham in the past year working on this election. And I can tell you every single day I was hearing stories from millennials who feel like their life is on hold. They can't buy a house. They can't start a family. They can't get their career going the way they feel they should. And we're a generation that deserves better. And I think as we really come to see that we deserve better, there'll be no choice but to elect a new prime minister. Trudeau doesn't deserve our loyalty.
Were you seeing, because there's always been that issue with youth voter apathy that we were told. And one of the reasons that Justin Trudeau did so well with millennials in 2015 wasn't because these millennials were non-liberal voters that voted liberal. It was they were non-voters. And just, you know, he offered them, in some cases they wanted, you know, legalized pot. In other cases they wanted that bigger, brighter future. And are you still seeing that apathy? Are you seeing that people in that younger demo are really, really engaged and really active in politics right now?
Well, part of it is just a matter of maturation,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the people that were 18 in 2015 are now
you know, now our generation is the biggest cohort in terms of a voter bloc in Canada, and we're paying a lot of the taxes. We're raising the kids. We see what's happening every day, and we're feeling that pressure from the economy. So I think part of it is just getting older and establishing yourself and realizing we've got to take some, you know, ownership of the country and make sure we're guiding it in a better place. You know, I'm 36. Me getting elected is part of our generation sort of getting into parliament, making our voice heard, that we're no longer going to be just on the margins as like the young voice, but we are the voice, mm-hmm. that we are part of this team, treated like equals, just like everybody else.
One thing that I will say that was great about your swearing-in ceremony was that you were unafraid to share who you were. And you had a worship team there. You had a pastor there. You had all of these things that we're told are not supposed to be a part of politics. So you're a different type of candidate. And I think you're a different type of, you know, you're certainly part of a different generation. But I'm curious how that weighs on you. Like, have you had an opportunity to take stock of, like, what type of MP you want to be?
Yeah, I've led with honesty and transparency the entire way through. I think that is what has made Pierre Poilievre catch fire in this country, is that people see him as someone who's willing to tell the truth, confront the liberal media when they're not giving us a fair shake. And I think that's what people want from their politicians right now. They want someone who, when they see them on YouTube or they see them on television or hear them on the radio, that we're going to tell the truth. And we're more loyal to the people of Canada than we are to the liberal establishment and the liberal institutions that want to shape and dictate public opinion. So I'm very clear about who I am, my beliefs, my values, and I think that is why people of all different cultures and backgrounds trust me to represent them, because they know whether I'm knocking on their door or they're watching me on TV or on the internet, that I'm telling them what it is, and that if I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it.
So what is it that you would like to achieve in the next, I mean, let's assume you have 18 months in this role before you're back to the polls again. Do you have a bucket list of things that you feel you could get done within that relatively short period of time?
My first goal right now is just to kind of learn how everything
works. Well, figure out where the bathroom is.
Exactly.
Figure out how you get around.
Yeah, like today is my first vote, and it's cool to learn how that process works and to participate. So I'm still...
Is it a good one, or is it like, you know, voting on, you know, like changing the signs on the... on the entry, the visitor center entry.
No, it's a good one. It's it's another effort to push back on the carbon tax, and I think that's a big part of why I was elected, was to continue pushing back on the carbon tax. So it's a good first vote.
Okay,
I'm excited about it. But, you know, and that's what I want to continue doing, is showing people that the affordability issues don't have to be this way. There are deliberate choices that our current government is making that is making life more expensive. And I want people to understand that, and not to feel that this difficult lot in life that a lot of us have been given right now is it doesn't have to be this way. And if I can make people see that, to have hope that things can be better, and we go into the general election with a lot of people saying we deserve better, we're going to change the status quo, I would feel like it was a great first year and a half.
One of the challenges when you're in opposition is that you're elected with this mandate, and you're, I don't want to say you're powerless. You can hold the government to account, but at the end of the day, the NDP has given the Liberals a blank check on this. And, you know, Conservatives have made tremendous efforts to, you know, with a non-confidence motion a couple of weeks ago, motions on the carbon tax that have just been blocked at every point. So is there a frustration you have already, not to take away your enthusiasm and optimism, about, like, people are in crisis now? And for some people, I actually don't know if they're able to hold on a year and a half.
Well, if we continue to do the job that Pierre Poilievre has started, which is to continue pushing the accountability to Liberal government, maybe we can push them to have an election sooner. Mm-hmm. I really hope that that's the case. We had a non-confidence
vote. You're not electioned out already? You're
ready? No, I'm ready to go. Okay. Listen, it wouldn't be the easiest lifestyle for me to go back into an election right away, but it would be the best thing for Canada. And if we can continue pushing the Liberals to the point where they feel they've got to call an election, or maybe we can get the NDP to jump off the Liberal bandwagon, get the Bloc Québécois on side to be pushing for an election. And if these changes we can push for, we can actually see some change faster than October 2025. That would be amazing. But even outside of that, you know, a lot of the committee work that, you know, my caucus members are doing on all these very specific issues, like the ArriveCan scandal, for example, they've done an excellent job of pushing for more accountability, more transparency from this government. Mm-hmm. And there are things that we can do just to make sure that things don't get worse. And believe me, without effective opposition, the Liberal government could just get worse.
Yeah, at the very least, there has to be something else to run when Trudeau says something about what the other side is. There has to be another side there. And I guess I would ask you then about how real that carbon tax discussion is on the ground, because oftentimes there's this divide between Twitter and real life, and a divide between Ottawa and real life. And I've covered a couple of the Pierre Poilievre rallies, one of which you spoke at a few weeks ago in Etobicoke, where he's talking about axing the tax and spiking the hike. And you see people out there at the doors. Is that penetrating to people that are not highly engaged or highly political? Is that actually a live issue for what we would call really ordinary folks?
I do believe so, yes. So one of the great things that we've been able to do with Pierre Poilievre as our leader is take advantage of social media as a way to communicate with the public and not have to go through the traditional Liberal media channels. And I think that has helped us get the message out there so that people knew what was happening on April 1st, that the tax is going up 23%, the cost of groceries, gas, and home heating was going up. And people feel that. Almost every day I hear from people in Durham, whether they're farmers or their moms and dads, consumers, people are producing various goods and manufacturing items, that they feel the tax is affecting them and their bottom lines. And when the Liberals come out and say, oh, it's okay that you're paying more because we're going to give you a rebate, I mean, they just like, what is happening here? Like, this is so against their life experience. So I do think that it is coming across. And I think people know, like, they can feel it every day that they're having to make tough decisions, where as they used to be able to do two things with their paycheck, now they can only do one, and it's getting tougher and tougher. So our message is definitely resonating. And I do think, especially in a place like Durham, where I represent, where you do have a lot of working class and middle class families, I think they can feel that they're butting up against a ceiling right now, that it's getting harder to get ahead in life. And the carbon tax has been one of the key policies that's getting in their way.
I'm just amazed as we close here that you're 2 days in and you're not even wearing your pin.
Oh,
I thought you'd be wearing that loud and proud just out there.
I've gotten to know a lot of the security and some of the local police. I've spent a lot of time with the guys who work at the House of Commons. So they do recognize me without the pin. I've been able to get in and out of security.
Back in the 2011 election, when you had elected all those like 19-year-olds from Quebec, the issue is that like the security thought they were all like interns. And they're like, no, I'm a member of parliament, but you don't need to do the don't you know who I am, because they all know who you are now. Well, congratulations again, Jamil. It's great to see you in this role, and I look forward to having you back on as an MP now.
Thanks, Andrew. Have a great time at the Canada Strong and Free Conference.
All right, thank you. You didn't have to organize it this year.
I did not, no. You just get to come and have fun. Yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much,
Jamil. Thank
you. Always good to see you, and you can head out that way there when you feel like it. All right, well, thank you so much to Jamil. We're going to continue on with the show here, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the bigger picture for a moment, because I have been somewhat disconnected from all of your comments right now, so we'll try to get to those in the shows that come this week. But one of the things things I've always loved about being at the Canada Strong and Free Network Conference is that in some ways it's a big old family reunion. So all of these people that we have on the show on a regular basis, like Aaron Woodrick from McDonald Laurier or our friend Chris Sims from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, they're all just walking about. And today, by the way, the conference hasn't even actually really started. It's going to be, I think registration opens at 3, so in about an hour and a half. And then we have the big event with Tony Abbott and Boris Johnson tonight. So tomorrow and Friday will be the big 2 days. Like I said, I'm on with former, I demoted him. I'm on with current New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs tomorrow, and we'll have some footage of that to share on the Andrew Lawton Show probably next week. And also Danielle Smith sitting down with her on Friday. And we've done that now a few times. I'm trying to remember, because I did one with her, well, at True North Nation, I did a sit-down with Danielle Smith, and then I did one also at the Canada Strong and Free Networking Conference in Red Deer, but I had like 10 minutes notice on that one, because they weren't going to do an interview, and then she had said she wanted it, and I was just available. So this one I had a bit more notice on, so I will have to come up with some stellar questions that I haven't already put to Premier Smith, but she's always been a big fan of True North and a big supporter of our work. But I'd mentioned, one of the things I'm interested in is how you get beyond the momentum right now that exists in the conservative movement, where Adam Bolek talked about this. Obviously, a lot of people on the right say, yeah, they're riding high. Pierre Poilievre's leading in the polls. Everything's great. They're all going to win. But what do you do with that mandate? And that is such a crucial question here. And remember, even if, you know, Pierre Poilievre wins some big, giant supermajority and he goes into parliament with, you know, 212 seats or something like that, what do you do with that? How do you keep the coalition that is required together? And I remember, not to besmirch the good name of Stephen Harper in halls that tend to view him very favorably, and I view Stephen Harper very favorably, but he was a very cautious leader. And even when he got his majority government, a lot of the big, bold change that a lot of people on the right had been hoping for and looking for from him never came. He never touched CBC, never touched the Canadian Human Rights Commission, left the Senate with a tremendous number of vacancies that will make it very difficult for a future Conservative government. I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but the Senate is going to be a big obstacle to what a Conservative government does. The Senate is going to be a tremendous obstacle, and it will take many, many years before the power balance in the Senate shifts back to a point where the Conservatives have a mostly automatic green light that they can put on their legislation. So that's going to be, I think, very interesting to see unfold here. So these are some of the bigger picture discussions that I would ask people who are here, especially people who are involved in the conservative movement and involved in conservative politics, to really focus on. It's, what are you going to do with that mandate? What are you going to do, and how are you going to get it done? And are you going to actually defund CBC? So that's going to be, I think, a crucial, crucial question that needs to be asked here. And one of the many issues that are getting all the applause lines at Pierre Poilievre's rallies and press conferences. But with that, I want to talk to someone who's on the other side of the coin from what Jamil Giovanni has just done. He won in a by-election here, and talk about a gentleman who we've had on the show a number of times in different capacities as a filmmaker, an independent media star, and now is a conservative candidate in British Columbia, Aaron Gunn. Aaron, good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I would like it noted as well, even though he's a politician now, he came unstaffed, so he's still flying solo right now. You didn't do like...
Not a politician,
you don't,
just
yeah,
a
you
candidate
don't,
yet.
Oh, yeah, you're a politician. I tried that line when I ran, too. But let me ask you, Aaron, first off, why you wanted to do it? Because you and I have been doing, you know, working in a similar space in independent media, and I've always said there's a tremendous influence there. You're doing great work there. Why did you want to shift into this role?
I think the big thing was, Andrew, as you pointed out, I've been making documentaries for the past couple years now. We produced over 24 documentaries and have been talking about a lot of these issues, investigating these issues, complaining and pointing out the state of the country leaves a lot to be desired, and I wanted to do something about it. And so this seemed like a good opportunity to step forward. So that was a big reason. The other reason is I just think that this might be one of the most important elections in a generation. And I got a chance to know Pierre through interviewing him a couple times. I think he's the real deal, and would love to be part of his team to write this country, get this country back on track, and write it to in the right direction.
You're in an interesting situation in your riding because you're going up against the NDP locally. Mm-hmm. Nationally, it's a fight against the Liberals. And I'm curious how that translates down, because I think we've heard anecdotally that Conservatives are drawing from lifelong NDP supporters and non-voters. And I'm curious how you're seeing that on the ground in an area where the Liberals are not really the first or even second choice for people as it is.
Yeah, they only got 13% of the vote in the last election. I think what's going to hurt the NDP the most, I think we're appealing to them in a lot of ways, but what's going to hurt them the most is that almost nobody voted for Justin Trudeau, and yet their member of parliament has been voting to prop up this government and everything that they've put forward for the past coming up on 3 years. So I think that's what's going to hurt them. We knock on doors. Nobody likes Justin Trudeau. That's the one kind of consensus up in North Island Powell River.
That's good. That's a good starting point when you go to the door and they already hate the guy you're running against.
Yeah.
That's always good.
That's what I say. I knock on the doors and I ask people what they think of the government in Ottawa, and I get a lot of laughs and smirks. But the truth is that the NDP has been, you know, voting to increase the carbon tax every year. They've been voting for these catch and release justice policies. And so I think it's the challenge that I have is just to make sure that people know that their NDP member of parliament has been voting with Justin Trudeau on all these different issues, not to mention covering up a bunch of these very serious ethic investigations.
There really are, in a lot of ways, two NDPs. There's the old sort of Jack Layton-esque NDP of the really, you know, the Farmers Party almost. Like, they go back even before Jack Layton. It's the, you know, the old CCF roots. And I think that's where a lot of your traditional union blue-collar types have found. And then there's this weird bizarro woke NDP that hates Israel and, you know, thinks that, I mean, everyone knows sort of the central casting NDP or I'm talking about here. And there has to be a schism there in that party that you must see on the ground where people look at Jagmeet Singh and say, I'm a union guy. I want jobs. I want housing. Like, this is not my NDP.
Yeah, well, the NDP, as you point out, used to be the party of the working man.
Yeah.
It used to be the party of the everyday Canadian. And now they've replaced that base with their new base, which is the woke mob, the people that are more concerned with renaming cities, streets, and towns and ensuring they're safe for the people that live there, more concerned with handing out free drugs and getting people into treatment and recovery. And I think the only challenge, really, for myself and for other Conservative candidates and the party generally, is just to make sure that Canadians know that, because they still have a brand that goes back to being the party that stood up for the everyday person, the blue-collar worker, and we need to do a better job of communicating that this is not the same party anymore. This is the woke party. This is the party of, you know, university professors and downtown Vancouver and Toronto. So that's the message that I'm trying to deliver on the doors. And we have to keep doing it, though, to make sure people realize not your grandfather's NDP, as they say.
One of the interesting things about a lot of your work that we've talked about on the show and talked about with you has been that you were ahead of the curve on things. Like, I remember with Vancouver is dying, Canada is dying, you were touching on these hot-button issues that at the time were not really mainstream issues and certainly not mainstream perspectives, whereas now left, right, center, mainstream media, independent media, everyone's looking at just the collapse of Canadian cities, the drug problem, the homelessness problem, and you were really ahead of the curve on that. And I'm wondering how that feels now, that things that in some cases were viciously attacked when you were drawing attention to these things are now like uncontroversial things to say.
Yeah, well, it's first and foremost, it feels good to see that there is, I think, a new common sense consensus emerging here in Canada about some of these issues. And to me, it should have never been that difficult to figure out in the first place that maybe handing out free drugs wasn't going to solve the addictions crisis, that incentivizing or making it easier to undertake antisocial behavior would somehow lead to good outcomes for society and for the communities and the neighborhoods that people live in. But it does seem to be that people are waking up. Unfortunately, I think that's the case of the situation getting so bad. You can't ignore, I think what used to happen when Justin Trudeau was putting forward these proposals is, quite frankly, they would be spun by the mainstream media, by outlets like the CBC, as to being positive or not showing the potential negative consequences of that. But you can't cover up with good media coverage what's happening in our cities if you live in the city. You can't cover up what's happening to inflation when you're the one going to the grocery store, you're the one going to the gas station. And what I hope in the future is we'll have less of that to begin with, so the faster uptake of counter-narratives with outlets like True North and others that are gaining a larger and larger market share in the battle of ideas that we have in this country. And I wish you guys, hopefully you guys will hold me to account if I'm successful in the next election.
Well, hopefully you won't give us reasons to, but yeah, we will. We'll do our part on that, as long as you just make good on defunding CBC so we have less government-sponsored, state-sponsored competition there. I'll just ask you about kind of your own technique. I mean, I actually heard you give a talk to student journalists a year ago about storytelling, and I'm curious if you have a way to integrate that in your campaign yet. I know Pierre Poilievre obviously has released a couple of these mini documentaries. Is that something you have a position to do at the local level, or is it just about door knocking?
Yeah, we got, I don't know if I'm in a position to announce anything just yet, but we're going to have some more. I'm not Aaron Gunn, the filmmaker, isn't finished just yet.
Okay.
but, you know, even once you get into the politics, I think if you're an effective campaigner, effective politician, it does come down to stories. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons Pierre has been very successful. It's not just about graphs and figures. And I think this is one of the reasons why the left has been more successful in Canadian politics, is because they're used to telling stories. Mm-hmm. And a lot of time to counter that, we just try to point out some facts and figures. We got to tell stories too.
Yeah.
And to do that, I think you have to get those facts and figures. You have to get those verifiable results and outcomes and relate them back to people's lives. And so that's what I'm looking forward to doing going forward. A good example is with those crime policies. It's not just about kind of the abstract interpretation of these bills, mm-hmm. or what it might mean. It's how is it affected Samantha's life living in Campbell River? How has it impacted Paul's life living in Comox, or et cetera, et cetera? So telling the people's stories and Canadian stories, I think, will be an ongoing part of what I'm doing, and really should be for everybody who wants to be successful in connecting with Canadians. Because I think we view our lives as stories. Mm-hmm. We are all our kind of main character, yeah, in our own story. And there's a bunch of common threads and common narratives that tie us all together, and that's the story of Canada.
I'll hold you to account right now, actually, because before you announced you were running, you recorded an interview with me that never saw the light of day because you went into politics. So we got to get that out at some point.
Oh, that's Putin and politics. Yeah,
so I wasn't going to announce it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's still, you know, we played with it a little bit. Maybe we'll end up releasing it. It was obviously going to be a different kind of show built on that comedians and cars coffee. And there's just only so many ways of doing poutine, though.
Yeah. I got poutine and a conversation with Aaron Gunn out of it, though, so I can't complain too much. And actually, when we were doing that, the former Deputy Premier of Ontario, who hates me, was at the next table over and had to see us being interviewed. Yeah. And yeah, so we got to have some fun with it anyway. But all right, well, I look forward to seeing what you do in your political life. And yeah, we have the standing invitation to hold his feet to the fire. So, but my challenge to him is to don't give us a reason to. So, Aaron, great to see you. Thanks very much for coming down today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, and you can just head out on stage left there when you are ready. It is great to talk to, like I said, all these people that we're usually talking about and talking to in Zoom boxes to do these in-person chats. So we're just warming up today. The conference is actually kicking off tonight, so we'll have lots more to get to in the next couple of days here on The Andrew Lawton Show. But from Ottawa, this is True North. Thank you, God bless, and good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.